Jason Waller here, True Underdog Podcast and YouTube channel. Listen, make sure you subscribe today. You can go to iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcast. You can go to our YouTube channel, True Underdog, or you can visit trueunderdog.com and subscribe to all of it.
Damn, 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 True Underdog. Damn, damn, unleash damn, the power within.
Jason Waller here, True Underdog Podcast. Super excited about the show we've got today. Today we're talking with Monty Moran. From a young age, Mr. Moran has had the curiosity to connect with others and share and learn their stories. He used that curiosity and empathy for the world of good, eventually becoming the CEO of Mesner & Reeves Law Firm and then co-CEO of Chipotle from 2009 to 2016 alongside his college friend, Steve Ellis. And listen, Mr. Moran, you have done a lot of things. I also love the title of your book, Love is Good, Guac is Extra. So I want to get talking into that. But how are you doing today? Where are you at?
Oh, there it is. There's the book. Yes.
I'm in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, weather's good?
Yeah. Oh, it's gorgeous. It's been great lately. It's almost too warm. It was almost 80 degrees yesterday, which is pretty weird for November, but it's been really nice.
It's like 75 here in Michigan. It is wild. I'm like, this is weird. It was like 40 3 days ago.
Yeah. No, it's nice here. It's been awfully nice. We had a couple cold days like 2 weeks ago, but since then it's been golf weather, you know, that kind of thing.
Do you golf a lot?
No, I'm not much of a golfer, but I live on a golf course and get to watch others play. I play once every now and then, but it takes too long.
You know, I can look good golfing and I can smoke cigars and I can have a few beers, but I can't golf for crap. Like it's right, it's left. I'm done after nine holes. I'm checked out. So I'm super excited about hearing your story, but I want the listeners to know, I mean, you know, you were one of the CEOs that helped build Chipotle during its major growth. I mean, that's a big deal. That is a major franchise out here. I know it's one of my kids' favorite establishments to eat at. And you have done a lot of things in your life where you've embraced ideas and curiosity and leadership and empowerment, different things that you've really led to do that. Let's talk about your childhood. As a child, I think that your curiosity really kicked in. What was that like? Did you know you were going to get into business? Did you know what kind of your goals were then or how your curiosity was?
No, I had no idea. I was one of these kids that just wanted to know everything. So I had, I had really smart parents. My dad was a cell biologist and super, super bright and spoke different, you know, spoke languages, played like 10 instruments, had a wood shop, flew falcons, you know, birds of prey. He was a falconer. So, and my mom was a really great artist and a psychotherapist. And so I just had these interesting parents who had all these interesting people over to dinner. And I just, you know, was one of these kids who wanted to know more and more and more and more and kept asking questions, probably obnoxiously. So I was always asking questions. I mean, to the point where my dad, to be honest, I could tell I drove him a little bit nuts, you know, because I just wouldn't stop. And I didn't feel as sorry for him when I was a kid as I did when I had my own kids and realized how much energy it takes to have kids. And now sometimes it's hard to keep answering their questions, but so I just peppered my dad with questions and sometimes he'd get a little stiff and, you know, I could tell that I was bothering him. So I did try to find ways of asking questions in a way that where he'd feel like he wasn't put on the spot and it wasn't because sometimes he'd say, you're like cross-examining me like a goddamn lawyer, you know? And, you know, and I'd say like, well, you know, and so I had to learn to ask questions in a way that elicited answers out of him where he'd feel happy answering them. So my curiosity started when I was a tiny kid and it never stopped. So,
yeah. Well, you know, you've been in different industries. And I mean, on your professional career, you know, you first were a CEO of Mesner and Reeves Law Firm, right? So are you a lawyer or are you, okay, so you went to college to be a lawyer.
Yeah, I got my law degree and back in 1993, is that right? 1993, I graduated from law school and started working as a lawyer in Los Angeles for a few years. And then I came back to Colorado to raise my kids here and got married out there, came back, raised kids here and joined a law firm here and then became I became a partner of that law firm quickly. And then in about 2 years after that, became the CEO or managing partner of the law firm. We called it CEO at that firm, but usually called managing partner of the law firm, and did that for about 10 years in Denver. So that was cool. Yeah, I loved it.
And then you took another turn to Chipotle, which is completely different than being an attorney, right? You said, well, how did that transition happen? What happened with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally different in the sense that, you know, there wasn't law work to do as the CEO of Chipotle, but there's something they had in common, which is that in both cases, you need to build, in order to have a really successful law firm or a really successful company of any kind, you've got to build a certain kind of culture. You know, you've got to build a culture that empowers top performing people to be at their very best. So I worked really hard to do that at my law firm. I worked hard to do it as an associate. I worked hard to do it as a partner. And the founder of the law firm, Corky Messner, he saw in me someone he thought would be a good leader of the law firm, saw that I was doing a good job with the people that I was hiring and overseeing. And so he asked me to become CEO of the law firm. And he and Ron Reeves, who was his other partner, those guys and asked me to be CEO. And I was honored and thought, okay, I'll take it on. And so in that role, I just worked really hard to build a culture where we'd bring in the very, very best young associates and put them in a position that would bring out the very, very best in them so that they could give awesome service to our clients. And it was great. And so one of my clients early on became Chipotle. Steve Ells, who founded Chipotle, asked me to start doing some of the lease work for Chipotle. And I said, wow, yeah, sure. And didn't really know what I was doing at first, but I went to the library and immersed myself and got good at it really quick. Yeah. And then I gave Chipotle a really, really good deal, probably too good a deal, because I was making about 10 bucks an hour on these leases because they took a long time. Yeah. But you know, it was great service to Chipotle and really helped, you know, help them at a time where the company didn't have much money. It was a very, you know, it was a small company back then. When I started doing those leases, we had 8 restaurants. So I got to know Steve really well through that. And he used to come over to the law firm to talk about things And he noticed the culture of the law firm. He came in and said, God, this place is awesome. I mean, you got all these associates that are working really, really hard, but they seem really happy. They seem really engaged. You can just tell there's great energy in the place. He goes, you know, how'd you do that? And at first I just sort of, well, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know, you know, but he pushed, no, really, how'd you do that? And so I started explaining to him how I went about building the culture. And he, long story short, he said, hey, I'd like you to come do that at Chipotle. Would you be willing to come run Chipotle? And at first I was like, no, I'm a lawyer. I don't know what I'd do over there. But he kept pushing. And after about 4 or 5 years, I agreed to go over and become president and COO. And then a year or two later became co-CEO of Chipotle. But he said one thing that was really key that kind of infected me. It kind of went in my ear like a bug and it wouldn't come out. And that was, he said, because I said, I'm a lawyer. He said, yeah, you know, you're a lawyer. That's what you're doing. But a leader is what you are. And he said, so I would challenge you to come over to Chipotle where you're going to be able to lead a lot more people and have a lot more, a much broader impact on more people's lives. And I think that kind of infected me. And over time, eventually I said, you know what? Okay, I'll try it.
Oh, he planted that seed really good. And you just would think about it. You have a bad day. It's like, man, I'd like to be over there. Or you hear some things going on with him. Couple things I want to touch base on. So, you know, myself, I've built a few companies and I've learned early on, my first company culture wasn't great. Second company, it was better. Company I'm with now, Power Home Solar, culture is fantastic. And you touched on something that's so key. When you build a culture where people that work for you act like they own the business and they empower themselves to want to move up, not only for income, not everything's about income, but to see a path for career growth in their business and to do great things, and you empower them to show them that map and feel important. When everyone's rowing the same way, I mean, it's infectious. Obviously, you had that in the law firm, and he wanted you to do that in Chipotle, correct?
Yeah, exactly right. That's right.
I think that it's so important because a lot of entrepreneurs out there, they think that it's just about the numbers. And really, you grow because of your people, right? You've got to find the right people.
No, it's sort of incredibly not about the numbers, actually. Right. You know, if you want great numbers, probably the first thing you should do is forget about numbers and start worrying about, number one, are you trying to do something that is a service to people or a product? Are you going to do something that people are going to love, that's of great value to them? So the first thing in building a business is, and a lot of people go into business, hey, I want to make money. If you go into business with the primary goal of making money, it is a huge impediment, ironically, to you making money. If that's your top priority is to make money, you probably won't make much. If your top priority is to do something awesome and that people will really like, then you have a real shot. I mean, you know, when Steve started Chipotle, Steve was an incredible chef, made great, great, great food, and took extremely seriously, you know, building these delicious burritos. And people loved them. They were inexpensive. They were super good food. Steve was, you know, created these amazing recipes and taught people to do it. And people loved the food and loved what we were serving. And you know, we were all very, very passionate about the food and about creating unbelievable customer experience. And so when I came in, I was like, okay, we got this awesome food. You know, what's the single greatest thing I can do here? And the single greatest thing I could do, I knew, was to make sure that every single restaurant had an awesome general manager who really cared about what we were doing, cared about their customers, cared about their employees, was a great leader, and could really create an awesome customer experience. And, you know, if you focus on that, then of course the rest of it takes care of itself. We had, you know, double digit comp sales, you know, year over year growth per store every single year, year after year after year after year, just compounding on itself. So when I started as general counsel of Chipotle back in, oh gosh, what was it? So 1998, I guess it was, you know, at that time we had, you know, our average unit volumes were $800,000, you know, and then by the time I left, our average unit volumes were over 2.5 million per restaurant. So an enormous growth in sales. And also the number of restaurants went from, I don't know, when I started as general counsel, about 8 to over 2,000. And so, and our margins got much, 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 much better because awesome people get a lot more done in less time, with less people, with less waste, with more, and take better care of the equipment, clean the restaurant better, you know, on and on. So yeah. It's one of those win-win-win-win-win-win-win things when you get a team of all top performers who are empowered. And this empowerment thing isn't just a word. You know, you hear the word empowerment thrown around. For me, it was a very specific word, and I came up with a very specific definition. So empowerment is feeling confident in your ability and encouraged by your circumstances such that you feel motivated and at liberty to fully devote your talents to a purpose. Okay, that's what empowerment meant. So I wrote that definition. I taught that definition to everyone in the company and taught people to really focus on the definition because it's not just words, it's also a prescription. You know, if your restaurant doesn't feel great, if it's dirty, if it's not operating well, if people don't seem happy, it's really simple. There's only three possible problem or underlying causes of that. Number one, you might have some low performers. It's not usually that. Number two, the people might not know what the standards are. It's almost never that, okay? Number three, the people aren't empowered. It's almost always that. So, right. You know, what it takes to have a great restaurant company, and forget it, what it takes to have a great company of any kind, right, is, mm-hmm. but I'll use the restaurant example. It takes, you know, people knowing what the standards are and knowing how to achieve them, which in a restaurant mm-hmm. company is, I mean, let's just, I'll give an absurdly simple example. You know, if you want to have clean tables in the dining room, you know, how do you do that? Well, you don't have to, you may teach people how to wipe the table once, but you don't need to teach them twice. It's easy to wipe a table. Okay, that's not hard. But yet most restaurants have dirty tables. Why? Well, because the people aren't empowered. Okay, but yet most leaders, when they see someone who, and I'm using this as an overly simplistic example, this dirty table thing, but it's a good example because right. most restaurants, you know, fast food especially, you go in and what do you see? A bunch of dirty tables. You know, they got some food on them, they're smudgy, it looks gross. Maybe less so in this coronavirus time because people are getting real crazy about cleaning stuff. But normally, yeah, you know, tables might be dirty. Is that because the people don't know what the standards are? Never. Do you think that anyone in the world thinks that a dirty table is better than or as good as a clean table? Of course not. Everyone, every employee knows tables are supposed to be clean. So if they don't do it, it's not because they don't know what the standards are. So now you're down to only right. now you're down to only two possible things it could be. Next thing it could be that they are a low performer. They're just someone who doesn't care and doesn't have the capacity to care. Well, that's very unusual. There are some times when somebody might not want to be there and they really want to be out racing cars and they could care less about their job. Yeah, that happens. But that's not very common. It's almost always that the person isn't empowered. Now, you take my definition. Feeling confident in your ability and encouraged by your circumstances such that you feel motivated and at liberty to fully devote your talents to purpose. Two big pieces of that. Confident in your ability, encouraged by your circumstances. Again, of those two, confident in your ability is the easy part. That means you got to train someone. You know, you got to train them how to do it, you know, and they got to know how to do it well. With the table example, that's really easy. You give them a rag and a bottle of spray and they can do it. The next thing is making sure that they're encouraged by their circumstances. Well, that's the harder part, okay? Because that means as their leader, you have to prove to them and demonstrate to them, number one, that you have a vision for them and for the company, right? It's like, hey, if we achieve our goal, you, Jason, you are going to, it's going to be awesome for you. You're going to become part of a winning team. You're going to become part, you know, a great leader of this business. You're going to become a leader of more and more restaurants over time. And we're going to change the way, you know, people eat food in this country and make it a more respectful, more delicious experience. And you're going to be a key part of that. And the way you're going to do that is by building teams of top performers. And here's how you're going to do that. But I've got to prove to you, I care about you, that I know you, that I understand you, that I am going to stop at nothing to make you successful, that I am going to challenge you. You know, I'm not just going to go easy on you if you're not at your best, but you've got to know that I have your best interest at heart. And if you know that I really care about you and I know you and I know what you want and I know how to help you get to a better place in your life and I'm going to stop at nothing to get you there, guess what? You're going to be excited to follow my lead. You know, if you believe I'm someone who has, you know, the intelligence and the vision and the roadmap to help you get there. You know, that's, you're going to follow someone like that, but only if they care about you, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but what's funny about most, and this is the differentiation between management and leadership, you know, management is about getting someone to do something that you want them to do. Hey, clean the table, you know? And I'm not saying management always sounds like, hey, clean the table, but basically management is about getting people to do what you want them to do. But leadership is about getting people to do what they want to do, which also happens to be in the furtherance of your purpose.
Right.
You know, yeah, huge difference. Accurate. Yeah, yeah. It's like you get someone, you show someone why doing what you need them to do is also going to be incredibly invigorating and helpful to them achieving their vision, you know? And so if you can align your vision, the company's vision with the person's vision, you know, and show them why that's really important to achieve, well, heck, I mean, then they, and if you care about them, you know them and they, and understand them and challenge them and are going to make sure they're at their best, they get lit up. They get empowered. They want to do what it is that will help them, but will also help the business succeed. And that's the kind of culture we built at Chipotle. But ironically, so many people in the management world or leadership world, they just keep retraining. God, you know, these tables don't get clean. I got to show them how to clean the tables again. Or, hey, the food's not being cooked correctly. I got to show them how to do it again. Hey, I've shown you this 10 times. Why aren't you doing it? I got to show you again. No, the answer is I've shown you 10 times. You still aren't doing it. It's not because you don't know how. It's because you don't care. And why would you care if you don't have a vision and you're not empowered? The answer is you wouldn't. So likewise, CEOs especially, they get in the game of trying to prove, you know, please their shareholders. Hey, I'm going to deliver a great return. And they talk about numbers and talk about numbers and talk about numbers. But guess what? Most of your employees, especially at a company, you know, like Chipotle, we had 75,000 employees. Do you think our employees really could get motivated about the stock price? That wasn't their world. Their world is they're in the restaurants working really hard. And what's going to turn them on? If the CEO is always talking about money? No. If the CEO is talking about, you know, we need better profit margins, what do they care? But if you're talking about, hey, you're important, you know, you're really important to the future of this company. And this company is important because we're going to try to change the way people think about and eat fast food. We're going to help you become part of a winning team of top performers who are empowered to achieve high standards, you know, and so forth. So anyway, you know, it's motivating people is almost never about talking about money. The good news is when you get a whole bunch of super motivated people who are empowered to achieve high standards and you've got a product or service that's worth it, guess what? Money happens. You know, profits happen, better margins happen, and better margins happen because really great people who are empowered get way more done per person than adding more and more people who aren't empowered. And so that's, I mean, it's true with every business and it's true about our country. It's true about any state, you know what I mean? Like the whole political thing that's going on lately, you know, it's like when you have people who aren't empowered and are divisive and fighting, you know, not as much stuff gets done.
You know, what you said is key because people need to understand, first of all, you can't chase money and you can't get people to do something if they don't want to do it. You can't retrain people. Everything you said is 100% accurate. And it makes me reflect on my company and go, okay, you know, our culture is great. And a lot of it is empowering people to look, if you're successful, this company's successful. We have a movement, right? Bam, building a movement, one panel, one customer, one employee at a time. So everybody's a part of that. It's not just, it's about profits, it's about growth, it's about margins. But what happens is they get real versions. Every one of our directors in sales and in installations and production, every one of our supervisors, every one of our project managers, every one of our district managers, they all started from the bottom and moved up. Were you guys a big believer of growing within rather than hiring people out?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, that's what this is all, I mean, it's right. So much of what this is about. And totally about giving opportunities for people who, when I came to Chipotle, when I first got in there, we had a human resources department that was hiring managers based on experience.
I hate that.
What experience? What experience do you think they were hiring for? Take a guess. We were a fast food company, so what kind of experience were they probably looking for?
Manager at McDonald's or Burger King.
Yes. And what kind of experience does that person have?
Not enough to do what you're trying to do.
Is it good?
No, it's not good. That's why they're looking for a job.
Exactly. Exactly. So why do I want to train? So instead of hiring for experience, I said, no, let's hire for character. Let's hire for people who have certain characteristics that you cannot train. And those are things you can't train. I mean, things you can't train. Hire for them. If you can't train them, you better hire for them, right? And those are things like someone who's happy, okay? Yeah. Upbeat, infectiously enthusiastic, presentable, motivated, ambitious, things like that. Conscientious, hospitable. And then you get those people in there who have these wonderful characteristics that don't entail having any experience at all. They might have absolutely no experience, but they got these great characteristics, right? That they're a solid person who can, given the right training, be an awesome employee and an awesome leader someday. And then you bring them in and you just, and basically, I mean, there's a reason this is called love is free. Okay. It's called love is free. Guac is extra. Guac is extra. Part's obvious, I suppose. It's kind of fun, but love is free is because, you know, in order for these people to really light up, the leader and the leadership of the company has to love them, okay? Now, love sounds so esoteric, and I don't talk too much about love in the book. Well, I guess quite a bit, but I don't. It's not about, hey, just go love them. It's like you have to demonstrate that love, you know, through caring for them, understanding who they are, looking them in the eye. And that's why I interviewed, you know, over 20,000 people in the restaurants while I was at Chipotle, is to really connect with the people that worked for us because they were superstars. And all they needed was someone to help open up that brilliance that was within each of them. And when that brilliance came out, guess what? That brilliance swept along with it awesome food, you know, low food costs because they didn't waste and they prepared everything really, really well. Delicious food that was hot, great service because they were so filled with pride and high energy and enthusiasm for what they're doing that our customers could feel it right across the counter, you know? And so customers are like, that place is awesome. And the people seem happy. Have you ever been to a restaurant that was delicious, but you had really shitty service?
All the time.
Yeah. I mean, I went to one last night. So good, the food. But the service was rude and careless, and I was just like, and it was no fun. I won't go back, and the food was great. I won't go back to that place. I'd rather, you know, have, I mean, why wouldn't you go to a place where someone who's serving you is loving it, they're having a good time, they're glad to be there, they're glad you're there. Well, that's the same thing. So I think a lot of people in every walk of life and in every kind of company, unfortunately, they get into, hey, I'm going to make a bunch of money. And, you know, well, that's, listen, I don't mind the motivation to make money. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is it's not very inspiring. You know, no one else cares. I don't care if someone else makes money and they don't care if I make, who cares? You know, that's not interesting. And it doesn't serve anybody.
They don't want to work to make the company rich. They want to work so they can be a part of something great and move up in something for themselves, for their family that they're proud of. And you're right. When you empower them to do that, it's exciting. And I think I'd rather eat bad food and great service than great food and horrible service. I would. I'd be like, food's not great, but I was having fun there. People like that feeling. They want to feel the passion and the excitement. It's funny. Everything you say, like our part of our culture at our company is, We don't care about resumes. We don't hire experienced salespeople to go in to sell solar, or we don't hire experienced installers to go install it. You know, we try to bring people in based on they're ambitious, they're excited, they're happy, right? Like the rule number one at Power Homes, you got to be positive. You know, you got to be excited. And we know, I emphasized an 80-20 rule when lost millions of dollars in 15 and, you know, sold my house, reinvested in the company, kind of got rid of almost all the employees and started this 80-20 rule. And I put it in place based on KPIs and results. But I always feel that you mentioned it doesn't happen a lot, but it happens sometimes. You get some people where it's just a job. And no matter how hard you try, and if the culture is great, there's some people in there that are just like rotten milk in the refrigerator, and they're going to start infecting others in there. So we have an 80-20 rule where we draw the line, and we always say, like, you can make mistakes. We can teach talent. We can teach you how to walk into a home and do a proposal. We can teach you how to get on a roof and install this. You could teach them how to wipe tables. You can teach them how to, you know, clean up or build the burrito the right way and be, but you can't change their attitude, their personality, and all the things they want in life and how they carry themselves amongst the team. And so that's what we try to train our managers to hire on. I got to get them that book so they can really emphasize on that.
Well, you know, it's funny. And there's a section in here on exactly that. In fact, there's one section that sort of brutally says, if you're thinking about firing someone, do it. I mean, that's it, because you don't think about firing.
Why waste time?
Yeah, why waste time? It's better for them. It's better for you. It's better for the business. If you're thinking about firing someone, and because you don't ever think about firing someone who's awesome for making a mistake, do you?
No.
I mean, unless it's a cataclysmic mistake or it's like sexual harassment.
Hey, it's a training issue.
Right. But if it's a training issue, you don't care. If someone makes a mistake, you move on. And, you know, but if someone's awesome and makes a mistake, you're not going to fire them. So if you're thinking of firing someone, it's always because you probably already should have. It's always because you should have already, you know? Anyways, that's another thing I talk about. You know, there's so many things in here that it's funny, when I first wrote the book, it was like really, really, really long. And I had this awesome help from this editor, Hal Clifford at Scribe. And he really helped me to cut to make it sort of just.
Did you write it yourself or did you have a ghostwriter?
Oh, I wrote every word. No, I wrote every word. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I remember when I first got an editor, I was like, hey, here's all the stuff I've got. And it was a lot. It would have been a really long book. it was a lot. But he was like, hey, do you want me to write some stuff for you? And I said, oh, no. Let me just, you know, if there's something else you think I should talk about, let me know. I'll write it. And so he was great. You know, he helped me organize it, which was something that I was surprisingly worse at than I thought I would be, you know, because I spent a lot of time editing my own book first, a lot of time. And I had a couple of friends help me and I got it all done. I'm like, okay, good. I got it all organized. Then I read it. And I was like, oh, it's boring. It's repetitive. It's like, it didn't work. And so then I took out a lot of that stuff and Hal really helped me organize it in a way that, where I think it flows really well. Everyone who's read it tells me it's exciting. It reads quickly and easily and gives them a lot of great advice. So I'm really pleased that it's had such a great reception. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm gonna make sure I get a bunch of those to give out to our leadership team because they absolutely need to not just hear it from us, but it's always great when you have outside influence of other successful people that have a part of a great culture and a great organization that helped develop that. For them to get that, it's exciting for them and they love stuff like that.
Well, I try to be incredibly practical in it too. You know, it's like I try to give lots of advice that you actually can do that actually will make a huge difference. You know, so it's like it's meaty, it's really useful. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't just put stuff in there that's kind of mealy mouth. It's all like, I mean, everyone who knows me knows that I'm super direct. It's like, I'm not going to beat around the bush. So I don't.
No sugarcoating. So I just did a deal with Scribe. So I'm excited to hear you use them. And then I Heather Monahan put me onto them. But, you know, I'll be honest, I've never read a book. Like I've done audiobooks and listened for an hour or two max. I have ADD to the max. I didn't finish high school or college, but you know, I want to do this book to kind of share my experiences, what I can do to help that, you know, you can overcome adversity. You can utilize some of the haters and the negative things as fuel to grow and you can create a positive environment for your employees or empower them. I want to like tell some stories and give some tips out there. So I did the deal. I'm supposed to do the book, but I've elected to have somebody write it and me talk to them. And every time I talk to someone like yourself, they're like, dude, you should write it yourself. And so I'm like torn.
Well, listen, I don't know. No, I there's absolutely nothing wrong with having someone write the book. If your strength isn't writing, but your strength is talking and getting it out there, I don't think there's anything wrong with having someone else write it. Like for me, I love to write, you know, I love it. I've written my whole life. I like producing sentences that I think are perfect. It's like they're little artworks for me. And I tried to write the book in a way that I think it flows really well. It goes into your head really easily. I'm really careful to use words that I think are properly descriptive and not overly so. And so to me, the writing of it was really a huge part of the pleasure of writing it because I like to write. If I didn't like to write, well, to hell with it. I'd get someone else to write it. I don't think there's any shame in that at all, Jason. It's like what's important is to get your ideas out of your head. You know, the stuff that's in your head that people need and can use, it would help them. Get that stuff on a piece of paper and so they and you can put it in front of someone. That's all. I don't think there's any shame in having it ghostwritten or having someone else write it. Just in my case, I wrote it.
I just want to make sure, you know, if I'm going to cuss and drop the F-bomb or say shit or whatever, right? I want to make sure that that's emphasized in there. So I'm going to have to tell the ghostwriter, you're going to have to write it how I say it, not sugarcoat it.
Well, that's it. I think you have to. I mean, you have to say, look, there's a certain voice I speak with. And, you know, I mean, you know, it would be, I can see, there, you know, there were some places where my editor said, hey, you know, I would change the sentence. And I was like, No, I really mean it just like I wrote it, you know? And we arm wrestled over a couple of things, but, you know, he understood. But, you know, most of the time, if he had a great suggestion, it was sort of like, hey, like one story that I thought was a great story. He's like, it's not that funny. Kind of falls flat. I'm like, really? I love that story. And he's like, it's really good when you tell it to me, but, you know, live. But in a book, it just falls a little flat. I was like, okay, so I took the story out. You know, it was like stuff like that where he was tremendously helpful.
That'll be good. I'm excited to go through that process. So, you know, you got a new docuseries coming out called Connected, A Search for Unity. Let's talk about that. It's coming out soon on PBS. What's that about?
Yeah, you know, well, at Chipotle, I interviewed, you know, like I said, tens of thousands of people in restaurants and got to know them and really was able to look into their heart, understand them and learn so much from them. It was awesome. So when I left Chipotle, one of the first things I did after I retired was I got my pilot's license because I'd always wanted to be a pilot.
How hard was that? I hate to interrupt you. How hard? My wife's like, you need to get your pilot license so we can fly places.
Oh, it's awesome, man. And it takes some work, but it's not that hard. You know, I mean, it took me a few months to get my pilot's license. And, you know, not all day. I wasn't working all day every day. It was in Colorado in the winter I started. So I got canceled a lot of days because windy and snowy and they want a novice pilot flying up there with ice all over the wings. So obviously, but no, it took me, let's see, maybe it was 5 or 6 months to get my private pilot's license. Yeah, maybe that long. And then it took me another 4 or 5 months to get my instrument rating, which is the rating that lets you fly in clouds and above 18,000 feet, you know, and file a flight plan. So you can, and that was awesome. That was harder than getting a pilot's license, but really important. It makes you a better pilot. And so I think anything that makes you a better pilot, you should do it before you get up in the air too much, obviously. So then I got this wonderful airplane called the TBM, which is the fastest single engine plane in the world. But it's also, you know, and it goes a long way and it carries up to 6 people and it's just wonderful. Really fun. Flies at 31,000 feet, goes 380 miles an hour. So I can really get around. And I was having a lot of fun with that. And then this friend of mine who worked for me at Chipotle named David Gottlieb, David said, hey, you know what you ought to do, Monty? He goes, you know, you love to talk and interview people and you've got this really great way of bringing what's, you know, the goodness out of people. You should just fly around the country in that plane and get a camera and sit down and start talking to people and like make a docuseries. Well, you know, I gave that some thought. And just like that bug I told you earlier, this one is in my, I thought, God, that'd be kind of cool. I'd like to do that. And so, you know, we went out, I started doing this and we got a camera crew and a producer. And, you know, we're doing a six episode, 1 hour each, docuseries, Connected, A Search for Unity. And it's going to be on PBS stations. And they've seen the first couple episodes. They're super excited. And so the vast majority of PBS stations in the country are going to carry it. And I'm really excited about that. But it's been awesome. I mean, here's the upshot. This country, despite what you see on TV, especially last couple weeks, okay, this country is not very divided. Not at the level of the people, it's not. It's not. People are super smart. They're wise as hell. They love each other, they care about each other, and there is an incredible amount of wisdom amongst the people in this country. And I'm not talking about CEOs and, you know, and whatever, people with lots of degrees or executives. I'm talking about folks, you know, people you land and you go and you meet them. Brilliance, tons of incredibly loving people, and from all different walks of life. I mean, I did one with the natives in southern Canada, just above the Montana border, the Blackfoot Nation. Incredible people in suffering some very difficult circumstances. They've got the highest incident of all sorts of statistics you don't want: teenage pregnancy, depression, drug usage, poverty. You know, and I went up there to find out, you know, why, you know, and then we went to northern Philadelphia to a place called Kensington, which has the largest open air drug market, you know, like heroin in the United States. I mean, people are buying and selling drugs on the street and there's no police are walking by. They can't do anything about it. It's just absolutely open air, you know, and yet this is hurting a lot of kids, and it's hurting a lot of, especially the kids who have to step over needles on the way to school, and they've got almost always either their parents or their grandparents or their brothers and sisters are messed up in this opioid addiction stuff, and it's horrible. But in there, what did I find? Again, incredible people, geniuses, brilliant folks who are trying to help with these problems. And then we did one in Georgia. Brunswick, Georgia, with where I went and spoke with Ahmaud Arbery. He was the young black man who was shot by some white guys in a neighborhood called Satilla Shores out there. Well, I met with his father, his uncle. I spoke with his mother. Incredible people. And, you know, these are people who just suffered the worst loss that really anyone could ever suffer. And yet, what did I find in them? Did I find bitterness and anger and hatred for me for being white? No. I mean, of course, they're hurting. Of course, they're angry at some things that they should be angry at. And of course, they want to see a world that is without racism. But by the same token, they were filled with love and compassion and a desire for things to get better. And they didn't look at me as, you know, some jerk, you know, white guy. There wasn't racism pointed my way. And instead, they said that, you know, they thought racism is actually very uncommon. But when someone's racist, it was funny, Marcus, so Ahmaud's father, Marcus, said, you know, when someone's a racist, they should have to tattoo it on their forehead so I can know to avoid them, you know? He said, and I asked him, I said, do you think that maybe since I'm a white guy and I'm sitting here with you that I'm at least partially racist for being white? And he screamed, hell no, you know, no. He goes, no, you got to learn to be a racist. Your parents got to teach you that stuff. He goes, if people grow up just black people and white people next to each other, their natural instinct is to love each other, care about each other, get along. And, you know, it was so wonderful to see that and to hear that from people who were just, I mean, honestly, just have been through the worst tragedy that any parent can ever imagine. And here they were being accepting, loving. I'm in his living room. I've been welcomed. I'm talking to him. He's got nothing to gain out of this besides to have his truth understood and heard. And, you know, did one in West Virginia. Anyway, wonderful. And it's just been a huge eye-opener about what a special country we live in and how really we're much more the same. And, you know, we got a lot more in common than we have different.
Yeah, I agree with you. I wish, you know, my kids growing up, I've got four kids, 22, 16, 13, and 10. You know, I have three girls and a son. And I remember, and I've told this story before on a podcast, you know, I grew up in Arizona. And out in Arizona, Nevada, and Colorado, and New Mexico, in my opinion, at least for me living there, North Carolina, Michigan, I felt like Arizona was probably the least racist when I grew up out of all the places I've lived. And, you know, I grew up there, but when I moved to North Carolina, it was different. I saw it was 94 when I moved in, and when I went to the lunch for the very first time, you had black kids at certain tables and white kids at another table. And I was used to having all kinds of friends, black, Hispanic, white, Jewish in Arizona. And I was like, I didn't fit in. I struggled, right? I hung out with kids that lived in the trailer park with me. Some were black, some were Hispanic, some were white, but we didn't look at that. But there was a culture divide, a serious divide there when I moved there in 94. It's gotten better over the years, but that's just not even that long ago, where naturally, because in my opinion, because the schools, I mean, I wish there was a way to reset everything and pay teachers and pay cops and pay our military and pay firemen and pay ambulance, starting at 100 grand a year. Treat those jobs like an attorney. And if we did that and we hired the requirements, it's really about education and schooling. Because we have, you know, teachers that get paid a lot less that are in inner cities, if we blended that a little bit and blended the kids a little bit, they would grow up amongst each other and be, I mean,
it's funny you're saying this, Jason. I agree. It's funny you're saying this, because at one of the things I do in the docuseries is I have some voiceover where I'm discussing, kind of giving some of my thoughts, you know, by way of wrap-up or introduction or wrap-up during the show. One of the things I say at the end of the Philadelphia episode is, I said, you know, it's, if we're going to have a common system of laws throughout the United States, we should also have a common system of enforcement. Likewise, if we're going to have a common system of public education, we should have a system whereby every kid in every city, I don't care if it's inner city Detroit or inner city Chicago, or, you know, the suburbs and outside of Phoenix or Scottsdale, every kid should have not only an opportunity for an education, but a certainty that they are put into an educational system where the teacher is empowering, super, super bright, super caring, and stops at nothing to make sure that those kids get the very best education they can get. I worry personally less about sort of income inequality after the fact. I worry more about opportunity inequality. You know, when you get these kids that they're stepping over needles, their dad or mom is involved in drugs, the parents aren't paying them any attention, the kid has no idols or sort of mentors in life that are doing something other than, I mean, in some of these neighborhoods, it's just hard to have a goal other than, you know, what they told us. One guy told me that, hey, I grew up wanting my own street corner, like my own corner to deal on. Like, I just hoped I'd get my own street corner someday. That was my goal. Well, if that's your goal, man, it's tough to, you know, to rise into, to partake of the American dream. But if we can give every kid in the country a real reason to know that the American dream not only is real, but accessible to them through awesome education and great teachers, that'd be a huge winning start. And to your point, I'd say, look, let's pay teachers whatever we need to pay them, and a lot more, to make a lot more than they make now. Let's pay teachers more and make sure that we got the very best teachers, that they are doing an awesome job, and that they are delighted to go to jobs in inner cities. And if you got to pay them a little bit more to go tackle a very difficult inner city school, then pay them more. But make sure you attract top talent to these schools that are right now having a really hard time, where you've got a lot of illiteracy and dropouts.
Think about teachers that pay to go to college, get their degree, and then they're making nothing. They're making very little. And same thing with police officers. I mean, I feel like a lot of people that I went to high school with that maybe were bullied or didn't have a great high school, they get in to be a cop. There's nothing else for me. I'm just going to be a cop. And then the whole mentality changes of power for them. And then there's a lot of power tripping with law enforcement. A lot of police officers are fantastic, but there's an issue with some where that happens, right? And it's because of the lack of requirements and the pay. It's the same thing with our front lines and military. People think, oh, I haven't done anything. Yeah, training. You're right. Training And so if you got, this is just my theory, you got rid of the United States Postal Service, nobody wants to hear that. And you give them a nice big balloon package and you give them an opportunity to get other jobs, right? We're in the renewable energy business. We'll always hire some postal workers. But what happens is the government gains some money. And guess what? You start putting requirements up for teachers. You start empowering teachers and get, because I know so many people that would have loved and would have been the best teachers I've ever seen, right? Guess what? The pay's not there to provide for your family. It's not fair. So we end up going in different directions. And I just hate that for our kids growing up in inner city, suburbs, everywhere it's going on. The public system is broken.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really tough. And it could be much, much, much better. I mean, whatever we do, we need to be attracting really, really excellent people to get into the teaching profession or the police force or what have you. And there are a lot of excellent people going into it, but we got to attract tons of excellent people such that it's highly competitive to become a policeman. So it's highly competitive to become a teacher, you know, so that we have the very best teachers rising up and staying involved with helping kids learn. And, you know, if every kid had an equal opportunity, truly an equal opportunity in the educational system, it would be a huge change to our country. Because, I mean, it's impossible that every kid's going to get an equal opportunity. That's period, right? Because some parents are better parents. Some parents aren't as good. Some parents have more resources. Some parents have less resources. But the education thing is one thing that we should be able to at least do a lot better to make it equal throughout the country, for sure.
I agree. I'm going to have to check that out. That comes out in February on PBS?
Yeah, February, March should be on PBS. Yep. And yeah, hopefully people like it. I'll tell you, it's really different, right? Because this is nonpartisan, right? Non-political, non-religious. It is an unbiased look where I'm actually trying to bring out what's true about people and help them share their wisdom in a way that's accurate, true, and digestible. I'm not trying to put any spin on this, Jason, you know, and that makes it very different than any other show, you know, and probably, I don't know that it's ever really been done before. You know, most reality shows have very little to do with reality, right?
Right. Yeah. There's a motive behind their shows to create chaos.
Yeah. Create chaos, create a certain outcome and create excitement. Nothing wrong with that. That's fine. That's not what we're doing. You know, we're going out and trying to really prove about the, you know, show what's, you know, how people are united and how they've got so much in common and how much we can learn from one another. And as we get to know each other better, you know, as we really look into each other's eyes, I don't care what color you are, sexual orientation, race, religion. Yeah. If you sit down and really look at someone in their eyes and are present with them and get to know them, you know, what happens inevitably is you'll start to feel compassion. You'll start to feel love for them. You'll start to understand their situation. And when that happens, it just brings people together. You know, division seems something that's absurd or outdated. Yeah. And that's how I'd like to see, you know, things like racism start to completely go away someday. And I still believe racism will, you know, will it ever go to absolutely nothing? Well, probably not, because there will always be people raised to hate. But it can diminish more and more and more. And I think the answer to diminishing things like division and racism and hatred is understanding. Love, understanding, compassion, but really just understanding. Because when I really get to understand somebody, even if you and I have opposite views on a lot of things, if I sit down, I really understand, well, let's see, why does Jason have those views? What's the deal, Jason? Why do you believe X, Y, Z? And if I really get to know why you believe it, what your background was, what your history was, I'll start to go, oh God, I can see how he has those opinions. I might still disagree with him, but if I understand how you got them, I'm not going to hate you. You know, I might try to convince you that you're wrong, you know, but you might also be more interested in having me convince you you're wrong if you know that I really care about you. And then you can, you know, we can come to, you know, or vice versa. You know, you find out that I'm wrong about something, but you forgive that I'm wrong and it doesn't matter so much I'm wrong. You take the time to maybe teach me to help me understand the right answer. You know, and then it brings us together. And that's, to me, what I'm about, what I really have found I'm about in this life is I'm about bringing people together. I want to bring people together. I want to help create unity, you know, and that's why our show is called, you know, it's called Connected, A Search for Unity. I want to bring unity to our country and hopefully to our world. I'm not implying that I can do all that myself. Of course I can't, but I want to be a force for unity. Let's put it that way. And I think the show is one way of trying to do that.
Well, no, I'm excited. We're going to definitely have to check it out and check out the book. Love is free. Guac is extra, right? I'm going to have to email and touch base with you, get some for our leadership team. There's the book. And then the show comes out in February on PBS. Thank you so much for joining the show. This was fun.
This was exciting. I got to understand it's someone else that loves culture and loves to bring people together and have them row for the same stuff. Hopefully the listeners and viewers out there know that, look, you know, from another entrepreneur to another entrepreneur and a business owner, you know, this in order to do things, you got to always help people. You got to have a good why. You got to have a reason to do things. Don't chase money. Try to help the world. Try to help people out. Try to do good things and good things happen.
And the good news is, and the good news is that the money will follow anyway.
That's true. Well, thank you so much, Money. I appreciate that. That's a wrap here on True Underdog. Bam!
And that concludes another episode here on True Underdog. If you're interested in hearing more, make sure you subscribe at iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the YouTube channel. You can always visit trueunderdog.com, subscribe to all of them. Make sure you check out our newest episodes coming out on Mondays and Thursdays. True Underdog, baby. Bam!
True Underdog. Bam! Unleash the power.